Today, Boris Johnson says that girls' education across the world is a priority for him. So as he prepares to host the G7, why is he giving up Britain's legal commitment to international aid? Since 2015, the UK has been legally committed to spending 0.7% of its national income on international aid. But in the last budget, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak said this year the target would not be hit.
During a domestic fiscal emergency, when we need to prioritise our limited resources on jobs and public services, sticking rigidly to spending 0.7% of our national income on overseas aid is difficult to justify to the British people.
Instead, the government will reduce spending to 0.5% of national income. It doesn't sound like a big cut, but it is. It means £4 billion less spent on overseas aid this year. Here is how that feels in Haiti.
I must honestly say that I'm personally, it's kind of interesting, after 22 years of working for the United Nations, I feel actually quite emotional talking to you, because it's a devastating blow to our program.
This is what it means in Zambia.
This is what we know, that by August, in the next 3 months, the project is closing. And so the other questions I'm unable to answer why it's like this.
And here is what is happening all over the world.
Overall, we'll be losing £72 million. It will stop the services we're providing in countries such as Chad, Mauritania, Democratic Republic of Congo, Cote d'Ivoire, Cameroon, and Nigeria, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Zambia, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe. And when I say stop, I mean really with immediate effect. We've got to close down by July 2021.
From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, Boris Johnson says he has to cut international aid because of COVID. But is that really what this is all about? Patrick Winter, you're The Guardian's diplomatic editor and previously were political editor. People might find it strange that the former Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron, was the person who enshrined in law our commitment to spend 0.7% of national income on international aid. What was his motivation for that?
Well, I think as part of the Cameron decontamination strategy, the idea of trying to ensure the Tory party was no longer seen as the nasty party, he had really put a lot of emphasis on this issue of aid.
And to those who are sceptical, I would say it is not only the moral obligation that better off countries have to tackle poverty in our world, where we still have over a billion people living on less than a dollar a day, but it's also in our interests that we build a more prosperous world.
He'd said often at meetings, I remember him quite strikingly saying, we've got to stop talking about Rhodesia and Gibraltar, and we've got to start also talking about Rwanda and poverty. I mean, you can take a kind of cynical view about why Cameron was doing this, but I think there was a sort of genuine motive behind it. I think he himself says he's part of the Live Aid generation. For his 18th birthday party was on the day of the Live Aid concert. And I guess at that time, amongst that sort of middle-class age group, there was a kind of commonality that this issue of aid and poverty and famine in Africa needed to be addressed.
What was that money spent on? What good was coming out of our commitment to this spending?
Malaria was becoming much less prevalent. Polio was much less prevalent. Poverty alleviation was really making a lot of progress in parts of Africa. If you measure also not just the kind of practical impact on the ground, there was also the political impact for the UK and its reputation as being this major soft power.
But on a domestic level, this was a period of austerity. So there must have been political pressure around protecting the budget of this department, DFID, the Department for International Development.
Well, it's the amount of money that DFID had, particularly, say, in relationship to the Foreign Office, you know, stuck out like a sore thumb. It was an extraordinary amount of money. I don't think anyone in DFID would pretend that at times that they actually had too much money. They didn't know. There was a lot of shoveling of money out the door right at the end of the financial year to make sure they hit the target. I mean, that was always one of the criticisms of the target, that it was too arbitrary, and then actually it's better to focus on what are you trying to achieve rather than how much you're spending. One of the ministers who had a portfolio both in DFID and in the Foreign Office was Rory Stewart, and he always tells a story about how when he was in DFID, he could airily sign a cheque for £30,000 and nobody would bat an eyelid, and he'd then go over the road to the Foreign Office and he'd struggle to get agreement to spend £3,000 on something. And it led to a lot of jealousy across Whitehall.
And there wasn't just resentment within government, was there? There was quite a lot of backlash in the media as well.
Now, I don't have a drama giving aid to people who are suffering, especially if we had a hand in their misery. However, the decision to give £98 million worth of aid to a country which has a nuclear programme, space programme and a thriving movie industry is insane.
Well, the backlash was not just in the kind of obvious newspapers such as the Daily Mail or the Sun, but, I mean, there was some quite persistent critical commentary in the Independent as well, and it wasn't that difficult to find individual programmes that were, frankly, pretty stupid. And I think also that after the departure of Andrew Mitchell as Development Secretary, there's a succession of other Development Secretaries who I think are less committed to the whole ideal of DFID. There was quite a steady drip of stories about waste being poured out from, you know, the Secretary of State's office, in effect.
I remember this period, and I have to say, I think some of the stories were really unfair. That idea that spending on India was effectively funding a mission to the moon. I mean, the money wasn't actually going on a space program. And then there was a huge fuss about DFID money going to the so-called Ethiopian Spice Girls. But that was just a tiny part of the good work being done by an organisation called Girl Effect. That coverage was pretty cynical, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, some of it was nonsense. I mean, at the same time, you know, I mean, there's, you know, even within the sort of aid charities, you know, there's been criticism of the amount of money some consultants are being paid. If you, again, going back to someone like Rory Stewart, who you know, is sympathetic to the department, sympathetic to aid, he would admit that the UK did not have enough people on the ground really checking how some of the money they were spending was, whether it was being spent effectively.
Okay, so Cameron then resigned. Boris Johnson became Foreign Secretary, maybe eyeing DFID's protected budget. And we know that as Prime Minister, he decided the department should be folded back into the Foreign Office. He began talking about trade and a desire to divert funds to domestic priorities.
If you go around the world, you'll find many other countries that are starting to question the utility of the way it works and wondering whether huge sums of cash that they spend could be better spent in the national interest. I'll give you one example.
And then we got that decision by Rishi Sunak to cut the money.
I have listened with great respect to those who have argued passionately to retain this target. But at a time of unprecedented crisis, government must make tough choices.
In effect, the budget for aid is being cut by a third over the space of 2 years, and that is a huge cut for it's about £4 to £5 billion, and you can't do that without there being huge pain.
Those cuts can be felt across a wide variety of countries and sectors. They amount to a 60% reduction in humanitarian aid to Yemen and 40% to Syria. And they're bad news for projects on life-saving water and sanitation, malaria, polio, HIV. And one issue that Boris Johnson explicitly described as a priority on his first day as Prime Minister: girls' education and women's rights.
For the equalities
on which we insist, whether race or gender or LGBT or the right of every girl in the world to 12 years of quality education, for the values we stand for around the world. Everyone knows the values that flag.
My name is Álvaro Bermejo, and I'm the Director General of IPPF, the International Planned Parenthood Federation. IPPF delivers sexual and reproductive health care worldwide. The UK is our largest international donor. Thanks to UK funding, we had provided contraception and other sexual and reproductive health services that had prevented, since 2018 when the program started, 11.7 million unintended pregnancies. It had prevented an estimated 4.3 million unsafe abortions, and through them, 34,000 maternal deaths.
My name is Luca Nkoma. I am the WISH project director. I work for the Planned Parenthood Association of Zambia.
So who do you help?
There are those that are urban-based, or our second group of clients are the poor, the very poor who are living in far, far rural and poverty-stricken regions. These are people that are living below $1.9 per day. These are peasant farmers. This is a group that is mostly cut off. They are separated by big, big rivers. And so when it's raining a lot in the rain season, they cannot cross these rivers to go to where health facilities. They cannot receive health care. They cannot receive family planning commodities.
My name is Yves Sassenrath. I am a representative of the United Nations Population Fund in Haiti. I'm currently in Port-au-Prince, which is the capital in the west of the island. We have currently 4.1 million people in acute food insecurity, of which 1.1 million are just below the famine stage. People do not have enough resources for one hot meal a day.
Wow.
And that also means that we are in a country where 1,500 women die a year in childbirth, which is the highest maternal mortality rate in the Western Hemisphere. We are the lead agency on women and maternal health, providing 75% of all maternal health and family planning and medical equipment to the country. So what we do is, and I've just come back from one of this yesterday, we do a lot of mobile clinics with our supplies and with our midwives. In one day, you have mobile clinics that have up to 300 to 400 people from all the different settlements that come every 3 months to the only clinic that they have.
If people are conceiving when they haven't planned to conceive, the end result is they abort. But with this project, we've been able to avert that. We've also been able to avert maternal mortality. You know that it's an issue in Africa, not just in Zambia. It's an issue in Africa where many women die as a result of pregnancy-related complications. So the project has averted these maternal deaths. And also, most importantly, the project has helped the young people to get back to school. They remain protected because they're on contraception. As a result, they're able to go back to school and be able to finish their school. And if they finish their school, most likely they'll get jobs and be able to support their families. So this is how important the project has been to us.
How much of it is funded by UK aid?
Basically, the aid has funded the whole of this project. So all that we've been doing has been as a result of the funding from the aid.
Do you know yet what these cuts will mean for your project?
Yes. it's a devastating effect that this is going to have. The project is coming to an end in August this year. So what it means is that we will not be able to receive funding anymore. The project is closing.
How much of your budget comes from UK aid?
The UK cut to our global supplies program is an 85% cut, right? From $216 million down to $30 million. If you take it concretely to the mobile clinic that I just mentioned to you, where you have a girl that I met with Samantha, who is 16 years of age, and she basically is still in school because she can get her long-term family planning injection. if I go to the mobile clinic in 3 months' time and I only have 15% of what I used to have in choices as well for family planning methods, I might not be able to give Samantha anymore her injection to be for 3 months covered and not being pregnant so that she continue her dream to become a nurse. It's a devastating blow because it's a systemic blow. It's like you have you have signed a contract to build a building and you've sold already most of the units, and all of a sudden you have only 15% of the cement that you need for the mortar mix to build your building. So if you want to build back better after COVID and build back better in terms of guaranteeing that girls in reproductive age can stay in school instead of becoming pregnant, or do not have to do unsafe abortions because they've become pregnant, then what kind of a building will you have? And speaking about Haiti, I can replace Haiti with Zambia, Burundi, Somalia, Sudan. You know, I can replace Haiti with Yemen. Maybe not. Yemen is even further on the spectrum.
Women will go to those service delivery points to get contraception, and there won't be any. Those that got an implant or an IUD inserted will go to have it removed, and there'll be no qualified healthcare worker there, or there'll be no open clinic at all. That betrayal of trust will be so difficult to regain. And the change is being presented as a temporary bleep that will soon come back. And what I'm trying to convey is that that is not true for women and girls around the world. These cuts have long-lasting consequences that won't be reversed, even if we were to return to 0.7 in a year or 2 years' time. You still don't rebuild that confidence in that clinic and get those women to come back. They're doing this and explaining it as the inevitable consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, let's be clear that there's nothing inevitable in this decision. In fact, no other government has decided to slash aid in this way and to make the poorest women and girls around the world going through some of their darkest moments pay the price of these cuts. We talk a lot about the UK public being sympathetic with the cuts. I think that has to do with the fact that for many years we've had ministers of development whose success, or what they called success, was presented as cutting back on waste, as if the majority of aid was going to waste. We're not talking about waste. We're talking about life-saving sexual and reproductive health services for girls around the world.
How do you feel about it?
It makes me feel very sad. I'm a public health practitioner, and we deal with people, we deal with human beings. A woman is dying because of being pregnant. This woman could be my relative. It could be my wife. So it makes me feel very sad that a project that has been very good, a project that has helped so many people, suddenly it has to come to an end. It makes me feel sad.
What are your fears about what is going to happen as a result of these cuts?
We are projecting to have a 20% increase in maternal mortality over the next couple of years, going back to 2000 numbers. The concern is that it's not just a reduction, it's a retreat. It's a retreat of something that I have already signed and a commitment that I have made with the country. So I have made a commitment to Samantha that in 3 months' time, I will go back to her village in her area, where I will be able to give the choices that I'm able to give now. It's extremely important. That's what keeps the women in school afterwards, because they don't have 2, 3, 4 children before they are 19. My concern being on the front line is, you know, my capacity eroding over time. My stocks, I've only got 3 to 4 months of stocks left this year. It's a retreat and not just, you know, a promise made and now, okay, we'll have to review our promise. It's a retreat from commitments signed. As you probably imagine, that hurts a lot.
Do you think we will go back to 0.7?
I believe so. It is the law, and it still is the law. And there's a reason why this government has not wanted to put it to a vote in Parliament. So I am hopeful that we will get back. I am also hopeful that other governments will step in to correct some of this. But let's not kid ourselves. That does not make the consequences of these cuts disappear.
You know, we've talked a lot with Patrick Winter, our diplomatic editor, about the politics behind this. How do you feel Boris Johnson thinks about this? And do you have a way to have a conversation with him and try and argue over this?
Well, he also claims to understand sexual and reproductive health and rights and gender equality and puts himself forward as a champion for gender equality, for greater participation of women in politics. But when women cannot control their fertility, when they cannot control their bodies, they cannot really control their lives and their futures. He also claims to be a strong proponent of women increasing their education. Well, the main reason for dropout from secondary education in nearly all these countries where I've said we will be closing down is pregnancy. So I would ask those who claim this how they can say both things at the same time, how they can cut this funding and claim that, you know, they understand the value and the great need for girls to finish their education.
How are you feeling about all of this?
I've always been proud that IPPF was in the UK because of the support we felt we had for our mission here. And now I feel angry and embarrassed. And I feel that way because of what this government has done, but also by how it has done it and how it tries to explain it. It really is a disgrace.
Coming up, what is driving Boris Johnson's government to make this change? Patrick, there is so much anger and sadness among people who are delivering projects that depend on UK aid. They don't believe that this is necessary because of COVID. And to be honest, as the aid budget is being cut, the defence budget is increasing by pretty much the same amount. What is this about for Boris Johnson? Is it a long-held belief, or does he think it might help him win votes?
If you poll Conservative Party members saying on Conservative Home website, the single most popular policy they've probably had is to cut the aid budget because it's seen as a sort of pile of waste in their eyes, and they don't see why more money should be spent on people overseas when there's priorities at home. All I'd say is that a lot of Conservatives themselves think that Boris Johnson is not hugely committed to overseas aid. He believes it's wasteful, and I don't think he sees Britain's soft power as something he needs to care about hugely.
And just like Cameron faced a backlash from within his party, Johnson is facing one too in the opposite direction. Baroness Sugg, who was an advisor to Cameron, resigned.
She told the Prime Minister it was fundamentally wrong to abandon the aid target.
The former PM himself has spoken out.
I think it's a very sad moment. That 0.7% commitment, it really said something about Britain.
I've heard Jeremy Hunt talk about this and Nicky Morgan.
Well, there are authoritative voices. I mean, every single recent Prime Minister, John Major, Theresa May, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, have criticised this. And there's a very wily, clever former International Development Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, who's a Tory and a former whip, who understands how to rally the troops inside Parliament, and he's very active.
Have you been able to sit down with Boris Johnson or Rishi Sunak and told them that?
Well, Rishi was kind enough to call me at the weekend and tell me what he planned, and we were able to have a short discussion about this. But the point I've been trying to make today in the House of Commons is that because of the 30% cut, 100,000, just over 100,000, mainly children, will die. These are preventable deaths, which Britain, with its programme, would have prevented. And, you know, we're moving heaven and earth to stop people dying of COVID in Britain.
So you're actually telling me now that this decision will kill 100,000 children.
I am telling you that the...
And he's been, you know, the invective he's been pouring upon Boris Johnson is something to behold. And I think the Conservative whips have told the Foreign Office that they've got to be very careful about preventing there being any vote on this in a form which could actually have an impact. I mean, you could have a declaratory vote, but what Andrew Mitchell's trying to pull off is a vote that would actually force the government to change what it's doing.
Is it fair to criticise the UK so heavily when even with this cut, it's still a massive donor of international aid and gives more than most other countries?
Well, the government's very legitimate defence is to say, yes, there are big cuts, but we will remain one of the biggest providers of overseas aid. I think we'll be sort of, I think now, third or fourth in the G7. The issue, though, is also the trajectory. A lot of other countries in the face of COVID and seeing what's happening in Africa and India are increasing their aid programs. We are reducing ours. But it is absolutely fair to say that we do provide a lot of aid. It's 10 billion. And it's a legacy that's under threat now.
Patrick, arguments are being made in Parliament that this cut is unlawful because, as we said at the start, David Cameron enshrined that 0.7% target in law. The government is arguing that it's temporarily missing that target because of economic circumstances rather than changing the target. But that argument cannot last forever. And from what you're saying, Johnson may not have the support in Parliament to change the law. So do you think he will reverse these cuts in the future?
I think people would believe if he would set out what he means by when we will return when economic circumstances allow. He won't even set out what that means. And I think it would reassure some people that he's serious about this. And he's not got the most brilliant reputation for veracity. There's quite a lot of former development ministers who feel like this G7 summit in Cornwall in June could be the sort of testing point. Because if he can get past that moment without having to spell out precisely when the UK will return to the 0.7%, the moment of danger from his point of view will be over and attention will stray elsewhere.
Patrick Winter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Winter. My thanks to him and to everybody who spoke to us for this episode from the UK and from Haiti and Zambia. If you want to read more about this, do check out Patrick's reporting at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.